We're really happy to have Seth Kantner here in studio. Seth is here at North House Folk School for the Winter's Gathering. He's going to be talking at 7:30 tomorrow night. That's Saturday night. Seth has published two books now. His initial offering was called Ordinary Wolves, and that came out, I believe, in 2004. His follow-up, which came out in 2008, is called Shopping for Porcupine. Seth was homeschooled and spent his early life on the land and most of his life on the land. He's worked as a fisherman, a trapper, a gardener, a mechanic, an igloo builder, and a professor. His writings and photographs have appeared in Outside Magazine, Alaska Geographic, the New York Times, Prairie Schooner, and other magazines, many other magazines. He's a former columnist for the Anchorage Daily News and also currently writes a bi-monthly dispatch on climate change for Orion Magazine, excuse me. His book, Ordinary Wolves, was a hit right off the bat. It won the Milkweed National Fiction Prize, the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Association Award, and also received a Whiting Award, naming him one of the nation's top 10 emerging writers. And I believe that award, Seth, bought you a little time because there was cash involved.
There was. Where I come from, people believe that if you write a book, you get $1 million.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's not the world I live in. But the prize did come with $40,000, which was a huge amount of money for an unemployed white boy. So I lived off that for a couple of years.
Yeah, that was great, and it's such a huge award for. Something I wanted to bring up right away is that you came from a very remote spot on the earth and miles from even the closest native settlement. Your father and mother chose to live off the land, subsistence living in Alaska. Homeschooled, as I mentioned earlier, you have a journalism degree. However, it's a huge leap for anybody to write that initial novel. Takes a lot of guts and a lot of time. You must have had a kind of a burning ideas in your mind to push out there.
Well, Buck, you just you stepped right in it. I don't know where to start, but
sure.
It's so convoluted. I was born there in that igloo about 30 miles from an Eskimo village, and I never wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be Eskimo and figured, you know, if I worked hard enough, I'd get there. I wanted to trap and hunt. My mom was sort of adamant that we didn't speak too crappy of English. But the village was encouraging that you don't speak too many big words, preferably about six or eight of them. Not big ones, six or eight small ones used repeatedly. I went to college only to find a girlfriend, not to learn how to write or...
I can understand that motivation.
Yeah, get an education. I grew up without people around, so it seemed important. I was wildly unsuccessful at I accidentally took a creative writing class amongst ROTC and I'll joke and say badminton, but basically I was just taking classes and took this thing called creative writing, which I knew nothing about, had no interest in being a writer, and sort of got accidentally on the wrong trail. And this is a person who, any book that was hard to read, didn't read it, unless, you know, of course, there's no books left in the house for a month and you started trying to read Moby's Dick. Spelling was something I couldn't do. All the stuff that you should probably, work on if you want to be a writer was not in my, arsenal. I did have stories that, I felt strongly about. And I did have sort of a lack of, I just didn't fit in. So writing was sort of a route to connecting.
Sure.
Connect, some sort of attempt to connect. But it took me 12 years to write, 20 years of trying, and, you know, 12 years of working on that novel.
Can you, I was fascinated by your descriptions in Ordinary Lives, and it was obvious, or excuse me, Ordinary Wolves, it was obvious.
Ordinary Lives would have been a fine title.
Yeah, a good one too, but, you know, the sense of place that comes out of that book is just so accurate. It's just so detailed and so full of that life that you grew up with that it was obvious that somebody writing this had really experienced it.
That worked in two directions for me.
Sure.
I'm apparently good at interrupting you, but
that's good.
That worked in two directions for me. One was when people read it, they started saying, you know, hey, this isn't fiction, which was astute and to a certain extent correct. The other was that, you know, it took so long to get published that I actually was able to experience another, I experienced 48 seasons waiting to between when I started and finished it. So I had time to notice the seasons and mm-hmm. you know, go, and I rewrote it so many times that I noticed that I've gotten credit for details that if it had gotten published after, you know, 3 years, say 3 years of trying to, it wouldn't have been as good a book. And that's that's a tough spot as a writer because you sure want to get your stuff published, but it's not a bad thing if it ends up being better. Somewhere along the line, there's a trade, a line.
A lot of time.
Yeah.
A lot of time to go into a book, and it takes an amazing amount of persistence. I want to veer off of that just a little bit. Last year, there was a talk at North House, where you'll be speaking tomorrow, about two of our, so maybe you'd call them elders here in the community. They're, you know, getting to the 80-year of age, and they both grew up on Isle Royale as commercial fishermen.
Oh, very neat.
They have stories to tell.
Very neat.
So it was a fascinating hour with these two gentlemen telling stories about their experiences, and a week later, one of them was in my store, and I told him how much I appreciated hearing those stories, and he says, you know, I don't understand why people are so interested in those. I just don't understand why I get that reaction. He just, to him, it was just growing up. Is that a lot of what you feel too?
It is. When my book came out, first of all, I was totally embarrassed and wanted to crawl under a rock. And second of all, I thought it was the most boring story ever written. If I remember correctly what we were on the subject of, when my book came out, I was horribly embarrassed. They say in Inupiaq culture, Inupiaq Eskimo culture, you're not supposed to talk about yourself. There certainly is a lot of people busy talking about themselves, but I was going with that first thing, and so it was really uncomfortable for me to write a book. It's not a reading and writing culture, so it seemed, you know, basically to most people like an absolute waste of time to be writing a book, the people around me. Of course, it took so long that it went from, you know, something I was trying to do to something that people didn't talk about anymore because it was so wasn't happening. When it did come out, I still was really convinced that it was the most boring story ever told. So maybe those elders you're talking about are along those lines, where, you know, just because you wake up in the morning and throw some wood in the fire and go down and drag some fish to shore and dry them, and then go back up and throw some more wood in the stove, doesn't seem like anything you'd want to tell anybody about. but maybe, you know, enough years go by and people aren't doing it. Maybe it's interesting.
Can you briefly describe and I had to think a little bit as I was until I got further in the book about just what this wood igloo the initial, you know, your description of your home. It's not really an igloo, and it's not really, you know, a cabin, but yet as you get into it, you understand why it was built like it was. Can you describe to folks what you, the home environment that you
had? Okay, yeah, I think there's a certain amount of confusion over what the word igloo means. I thought it was, when I was growing up, I thought it meant, you know, a sod house dug into the ground. And I thought a snow igloo, which we made, but my dad had climbed Mount McKinley, and they'd lived in snow igloos up there, and they, you know, he was a white guy from Ohio who learned from some miners in Fairbanks how to make a igloo. But when he showed us as kids, me and my brother, and then we made them, then, well, the local Eskimos had never seen snow igloos before.
Oh.
So we thought of those as, you know, just snow house, which is probably seems all upside down when you're thinking of a... basically, the igloos on the coast where they didn't have trees were like whale bones and drift logs, dug a little bit into the ground, and the uprights were, you know, whale bones or logs, and then cross pieces, and then leaning poles, and then moss at sod blocks piled up, and often sort of a lower entrance or an actual tunnel entrance, and that's where I was born, was in a tunnel entrance sod house or a sod igloo, whatever. Later on, you know, paying attention, reading, you know, it came clear that as you went further and further north, there was less driftwood, less of that. And those Inupiaq or Inuit or whatever you want to call them, they probably, it's all confusing nowadays. But those Eskimos further up were living in snow igloos. I don't know. The old Eskimo guys that I travel with would still say something like, oh, we'd pull up to a beaver lodge and they'd say, oh, right there, a beaver igloo.
Sure.
So,
So
maybe it's house.
Yeah, but your environment inside of that was also something that most people would never experience. And when I read about, you know, you've got a sod roof and you've got the mice and voles running around when you're a youngster, and, you know, it's just a different environment than
it's the same as TV. It's just that the mice and stuff. If you don't have TV, you got to have something.
Yeah, they're the entertainment then in that. Now, maybe part of the reason that, and you can correct me on this, that you originally wrote a fictional work is because you weren't so sure that you wanted to put yourself out there as part of the culture that you grew up in.
You're on the trail, maybe a little off to the side of it, but...
Okay.
I wanted to say things, and I felt like I couldn't tell the truth with nonfiction. The only way I could tell the truth was to make it fictional. And the easiest way to, you know, say that in a big hurry would be, you know, there's so many, I guess you call it being politically correct. Where I come from, we don't understand that concept. Everybody's always shouting about white people this or natives that, and there's a lot of bluntness. Or openness, I don't know how you want to call it, but I couldn't really say, you know, George Johnson was drunk down by the river without sort of, you know, first of all, getting all my windows broken, and second of all, just making a mess of
sure.
Some pretty, there's some sharp tensions. So writing fiction, at least I wasn't pointing at actual people, but was still able to, I absolutely did not want to portray Alaska in some romantic, wonderful, noble natives and the noble wolves and the glaciers and all that, because that irritated me. I wanted to talk about what was good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
So I chose fiction.
Okay. Your main character in there, his nickname is Kutuk, and we'll get back to the autobiographical nature of that book a little more, but one of the things that really struck me as I was reading that book, it was the racism kind of as a central theme in Ordinary Wolves, but it comes about to the reader in a different way than he's used to seeing it, because the main character, Kutuk, grows up as a white child in a native culture, and experiences racism coming to him in that way. And yet when he gets to Anchorage later on, he still feels that he is less of a person than he should feel because of that that earlier experiences with racism. I'm not saying this very well, but it comes out so strongly in your book.
Yeah, it's, you know, we're on the air and live, and it's always, you know, you wonder what to say, and what, you know, you basically you want to say something that makes the world a better place, or don't say it. My experience with race was I grew up with such a strong feeling that white equals bad. Mm-hmm. That it was always a marvel to me that, like, when the new school teachers would show up, that they weren't embarrassed about being white. And then when I went out into the, I mean, for lack of a better term, the white world, Fairbanks or something like that, Anchorage, I looked somewhat, I mean, basically a white person, but I didn't feel like that under my skin. So I was around white people and didn't know basically any, didn't know what Doritos were or any of the cute things you're supposed to know. Looked like I should know it, so basically came off as stupid. And at the same time was still embarrassed for being white. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, you know, I was just waiting around to someday be Eskimo. You know, and that still sounds like you're retarded, or I am, but if I think things soak in when you're little.
Sure.
And there you go.
They never change.
I can't, you know, people talk, you know, they're talking about Native pride at home and stuff like that, and, you know, it's hard for me to accept that you even need to talk about it, because I think, you know, why wouldn't a Native be proud? I mean, you're Native. I mean, that's what I wanted to be, but it's not so simple.
What I got out of it as a reader was a perspective which really allowed me to understand racism as affecting minorities such as Natives and Blacks and other people of minorities that I couldn't see as well without reading something like you wrote.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because, you know, I get people asking me about wolves and you know, lots of questions, global warming, Sarah Palin, whatever. But often not what you're asking, and that's it's always good to hear not that buzzing sound, but other things. Boy, hope that's not me. But it's always good to hear, and I do I do question those things now myself, because you know, I see a black person and I think, oh man, you're just isn't that the epitome of being cool? But you know, apparently there's places where it's not, so it's a confusing world. And I think the only thing I've got really is maybe just a weird perspective that is useful in that sense.
You know, I didn't. I meant to talk to you about this off air, and you can before I brought it up, but. You have a number of people, more in your book, Shopping for Porcupine, which is the more biographical or more about you book, even though your initial book couldn't be written without those personal experiences. One couple that you really have looked up to in your life was Bob and Carrie, and you can describe them better than I can, but there's a passage in here, and I'm going to show it to you briefly. Having to do with the loss of people like Bob and Carrie and the loss of subsistence type of living that you grew up with. And it would be listed right in here, and I'm sure that you'll remember it, because it's such a strong passage to me about the loss of a life that was very important to you.
Yeah, that's, you know, doubly sad for me right now, because basically Bob Yule was a white guy that went north right after World War II. He was part of what was called Kastner's Cutthroats. So it was a group of Bush people defending Alaska from the invasion of World War II. and a lot of them were natives and some white trappers and sourdoughs, they call them. Bob was a young guy from California, became part of the Alaska Scouts, and then was sent north to take care of the Air Force's dog teams. I don't know if the Air Force has a lot of dog teams anymore.
Probably not so much anymore.
And then they started sending Air Force pilots up there, and he was teaching them, cold weather survival. He quickly met Carrie, who was an Inupiaq lady, woman, probably, 21 or so, his age. And they got married, and they just moved across the ice to the far shore and lived there for 60 years or so. Maybe 10 years ago, they moved to town because of, they're so old. And then 3 years ago, I think Carrie died. Bob's in the old folks' home now. So I saw this coming. We all see the changes coming so fast, and I think it's just like America, but you know what America went through in 250 years or whatever, we're going through in 40 years or somewhere along those lines. Not very many years ago, people were out, trying to get a muskrats to sell for a little cash, and now we've got people are flying to Vegas to
it's all changed.
But watching the years coming towards us with Bob and Carrie out there in the land, and knowing that pretty quick that was not going to be something taking place, was hard to watch. A lot of it's been hard to watch.
Would you mind reading part of that passage?
I can give it a try. I hope I don't get too sad. So basically, I'm spending the night with these old people in their cabin. And the reason I was spending the night, I was hunting caribou, and the wind came up and hard to see. And then I stopped at their cabin to wait for it to get dark, because traveling by snowmobile, when it's dark, you can see better during a whiteout. The bumps and stuff. And I found out when I went inside their cabin that the wind had brought what we call overflow, so water on the ice, which is dangerous for getting home. So I spent the night with them. After all this food they put out, seal oil and dried meat and everything, Bob shuts off the light, and he's standing there in the darkness by the stove, and he says... Bob is somewhere in the blackness near the table, still talking. Thanks for the conversation, he says. And I could cry in the dark on this iron cot. I visit Bob and Carrie when I can. I try to listen. It's hard with my big mouth and poor memory and cluttered thoughts. Often in desperation, I fear the only thing I'll remember clearly about them is that Carrie has always called me Little Sweetheart. And Bob was wrong about the 4 cups of water. That refers to how to make rice. Lying here in the dark, I have trouble believing what has happened to the way of life into which I was born. Subsistence has melted in our hands. Living off the land, how did it drip away? How could the cash and computers, the canned food and machines have taken so much, left so little? So many of us trusted that we would be true hunters, but learned only how to kill, never made it anywhere close. We wander instead adrift, yet chained to the conveniences and the cardboard-wrapped contraptions. The old life has vanished. Bob and Carrie lived that life, breathed the land and walked from that past, carrying their mukluks and parkas and belongings into this 21st century. And now I'm falling asleep. Here in the dark, in their presence, I recognize a tenderness, a bottomless respect for the creatures and creations of the land, and I have no idea what to do with that recognition.
Thank you, Seth. It's so obvious how much those folks and other folks like them meant to you, growing up in the culture and environment that you did, and now seeing the changes that are coming so fast to that type of land. Seth, I had so many more things that I wanted to get to about your book, but of course, time is a creature of the radio. But I did want to ask you a couple of things. And also mention that your latest book, Shopping for Porcupine, also includes another part of your career now, and that's photography and some beautiful, beautiful photographs from the land that you know so well. For those of you out there, we'll mention these books again, but it's one big feature of your latest book. What is next for you? You've completed two very successful books. Do you have something else in mind?
I worked for 4 years on a novel, trying to write from a woman's perspective. My narrator was a young girl. I unfortunately grew up with very few other kids around, and basically none of them being female. So somewhere along the line, I was starting to feel like, you know, I like things that are hard and tough, but I was barking up a pretty tough tree. I jumped ship to another novel 2.5 years ago. It's about suicide, and that's a pretty big problem where I'm from. I mean, actually the highest rate in the nation. I sure hope it doesn't take 12 years.
Good luck with that one. You have a website of your own. Can you tell folks how to get there?
Yeah, my wife set it up. It's I started off with kavakphotography.com, and you know, pretty quick becomes, yeah, realize, throw an Eskimo word out, Inupiaq word out into the web is just stupid. I mean, nobody can spell it, and is that a Q or whatever? So it's SethCantner.com, which seems kind of cheesy, but it is what it is. Sure. And somewhere on there, I've got trying to be cool, I guess. There's some quotes about people like in my book, and there's some of my photos, but now I don't know how to put any more on. I got thousands of photos and like 8 on the website, and there's a few of my columns on there. I'm writing for Anchorage Daily News again, and those are on the web, and then that also goes to like the Arctic Sounder and the Bristol Bay Times and these other papers around the once a month around Alaska.
Now, were you able to? You have some books here.
I don't.
Oh, you don't. But they do at North House.
They do.
And folks that come and attend your part of Winter's Gathering, which is 7:30 tomorrow night, Saturday night.
Yep.
Can pick up books then, and imagine you'd be happy to.
Yep.
Scribble in them.
I'll make time for signing books and. And I'll show slides of the Arctic, and then who knows, probably tell stories.
Seth, you still have a little trouble talking about yourself, but you have a lot to be proud about in these two very successful books, and ones that, as I mentioned earlier, made before you came on air, I was saying this is one of the books I've read that really make a dramatic impression on me, and I want to thank you for writing it.
Thanks a lot, Buck. Appreciate it. I'm going to stop at your store and buy some fish hooks.
There you go.
I was actually going to before I met you. So.
Okay. Seth Kantner, he is the author of Ordinary Wolves, and his latest book is called Shopping for Porcupine. Thanks again, Seth.
You're welcome.